Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Hello, and welcome to New Scientist Weekly, your curated selection of the week's science stories. I'm Christy Taylor in New York.
And I'm Sophie Bushwick, also in New York. This week on the podcast, how distant Mars may manage to tug on Earth's oceans, a hypothetical AI takeover of your music collection, and an impressive new laser that uses sound.
Plus, why life in the seas of Europa may be less plausible than scientists previously thought.
But first, the war in Gaza is rapidly becoming the worst humanitarian crisis in modern memory. Israel has intensely bombed and blocked the flow of humanitarian aid into the densely populated enclave after Hamas militants killed more than 1,000 civilians in Israel on October 7th. More than 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are now facing widespread hunger, disease, and physical injuries, which will have lifelong effects for survivors. Our health reporter Grace Wade is here to talk to us about the public health crisis and the lack of plans to address it. Grace, could you tell us what you found in your reporting?
Yeah, so I reached out to multiple international aid organizations, including the World Health Organization and UNICEF, and found that none of them had any concrete long-term plans to meet the health needs of Palestinians in Gaza after the war. This is really concerning since we know from previous conflicts that war, hunger, and displacement can have lifelong health consequences, especially for children. So even if the war ends tomorrow, we're looking at a decades-long public health crisis.
Can you help outline the magnitude of that crisis? What it would entail for Palestinians?
Well, given the enormity of the current humanitarian crisis in Gaza, public health experts are anticipating a massive burden of mental illness, physical disabilities, and other chronic conditions. Right now, the majority of people living in Gaza, half of whom are children, by the way, have been internally displaced. They are living in crowded conditions without sewage treatment, trash removal, or reliable access to clean water. As a result, infectious disease is rampant, which can increase the risk of malnutrition in young children who are already hungry because Israel is also blocking humanitarian aid. So hunger is widespread. Some reports have suggested that almost two-thirds of households in Gaza are eating just one meal a day, and that's with food of the lowest nutritional value. This is a major concern for children particularly. Persistent malnutrition early in life stunts growth, impairs brain development, and weakens their immune systems for years to come.
Grace, this is all really horrifying to listen to. And you did mention mental illness. It seems impossible to survive this kind of assault without some kind of mental health effects, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. The most widespread harm will almost certainly be the mental health effects. Keep in mind that this war has been going on for more than 5 months now, and people cannot leave. They cannot feed their families. They cannot return to their homes. Almost everyone has lost loved ones, and many people have lost their entire family. Such traumatic experiences are associated with depression, anxiety, PTSD, and suicide. In children, this can disrupt brain and organ development and increase the risk of learning disabilities. Without early interventions, these problems may continue into adulthood.
And as you said at the very beginning, there's no long-term plan to help Gazans recover from this. So why haven't aid groups developed more comprehensive plans to address these issues?
Well, there are a few reasons. So the first is that there's a lot of uncertainty about Gaza's future right now, including when the war will end and who will be governing the territory afterwards. This makes future preparations extremely difficult, according to the aid workers I spoke with. The other issue is that Israel has limited aid organizations' access to the region, and the few workers who are there can't operate safely. Many of them have died, too. If aid groups don't know what the needs are in Gaza, they can't make a very useful plan.
Now, I want you to take a moment, hold very still, and concentrate really hard. You feel that? It's a gravitational pull of Mars, which is a real thing shaping processes on our planet. And you should trust me on this, or at least trust Jacob Aaron, who is here to explain it all. Jacob, please explain.
Okay, I should start by admitting that you cannot actually feel the gravitational pull of Mars. And if you can, you should probably report to your nearest physics lab for testing. But what's interesting about this story from our reporter James Woodford is the suggestion that every 2.4 million years, Mars may have just enough strength to stir up the Earth's oceans.
Jacob, that's so wild. I mean, I know Mars is on average something like 225 million kilometers or 140 million miles away. So what's going on there?
Well, we already know that the sun's gravity influences Earth's climate by creating wobbles in its orbit that vary every few thousands of years. The claim now from Adriana Dutkiewicz at the University of Sydney and her colleagues is that something similar could be happening with Mars. The team looked at almost 300 deep-sea drill cores, looking at layers of sediment deposited on the ocean floor. Now, normally these sediments should build up steadily, but unusual ocean currents can cause the layers to vary in different locations. And according to their analysis, absences in the sediment deposition records line up with times when Mars's gravity exerts its maximum force on Earth, which happens once every 2.4 million years when the planets align.
Hang on, but Mars isn't literally pushing those sediments around on Earth, right?
No, not directly. The suggestion is that this tug from Mars shifts Earth's orbital stability, changing the amount of solar radiation from the sun. This in turn slightly warms the oceans, creating stronger currents that shift the sediments around.
You said it's a suggestion, so is there some uncertainty here?
Yes, so we have had a bit of skepticism from other researchers we spoke to. One points out that even Jupiter has a stronger gravitational influence on Earth than Mars, so we really are talking about a tiny effect. And it's also important to put this in context. The changes in temperature caused by human-driven climate change are far, far larger than anything Mars may or may not be doing.
Speaking of bodies that exert gravitational forces on our oceans, there's of course also the moon, which you may already appreciate for its tide-creating power. But did you know we may also want to give it credit for maybe the entirety of scientific inquiry? This week's Culture Lab is all about the ways our moon is singular and special for these reasons and more. And that's already right there in your feed for you to listen to, maybe not right now, but after you finish this episode.
Meanwhile, if you just want to learn some delightful new facts about the world around us, next week's Escape Pod has you covered. Get revved up to hear about speed. We've got the fastest animal and the fastest supercomputer, plus a rapid history of our attempts to understand the speed limit of our universe. That's coming Tuesday.
The following message is sponsored by the UK Department for Business and Trade and the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency. In part three of our sponsored series exploring how the UK has transformed its ecosystem for clinical trials, we meet Dr. Melanie Iverson from the global biotechnology company Moderna to find out why she chose the UK for a £1 billion research and development program. Available free at newscientist.com/podcasts.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Up next, here's a thought experiment for you. What if every piece of music ever recorded in human history was replaced by AI covers of Taylor Swift songs? For many people, maybe that would be a great day, but researchers say we should use this hypothetical scenario as motivation to protect our data from potential corruption by AI tools. Matt Sparks covered this possibly harebrained idea. Matt, what do you have against Taylor Swift?
Absolutely nothing, I promise. But I think even the most obsessed fan would be a bit distressed to find out they now only had Taylor Swift to listen to, which is exactly what would happen in this scenario, which is, as you said, a thought experiment involving a rogue AI that somehow infiltrates the databases for music science like Apple Music or Spotify. It could replace Beethoven's Feralise or the Beatles' Helter Skelter with an AI-generated Swiftian cover. And if enough databases like that were breached or modified, then there'd be no digital record left that other musicians had ever existed.
Wow, that definitely does sound apocalyptic. No offense to Taylor. But how realistic is this?
Well, a team of researchers investigated the sort of practicality of this kind of attack by directing a generative AI to create some of these hypothetical covers. So Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody was one, and The Beach Boys' Wouldn't It Be Nice was another. They also calculated that if you wanted to do that for the entire body of recorded music, it would be quite pricey. You'd need 1.7 billion kilowatt hours of electricity at a cost of about $266 million, which, you know, is easily affordable for Taylor Swift if she wanted to do something like that. But then you've got to look at the probability of an AI gaining the ability to do that and gaining the ability to want to do that, which is orders of magnitude less likely.
Is there a bigger purpose to asking such an out-there-sounding question?
Absolutely, yeah. The team thinks that an actual Swiftpocalypse is pretty unlikely, but they want this thought experiment to sort of bring attention to the risks that AI might pose to other kinds of data. So scholarly research, for example, it could gradually get corrupted over years and years, especially if we continue to sort of centralize our data in just a handful of places. And they're hoping that computer science researchers will take this research as motivation to work on ways to protect data from AI infiltration for the next hundreds or even thousands of years.
It does feel, you know, as you mentioned, like this hypothetical threat relies on the existence of an AI with its own malicious motivations and goals, which, as far as I understand, isn't something AI actually possesses, you know, motivations and goals, malicious or otherwise.
Yeah, that's a fair critique, and other researchers have brought that up. One even compared this thought problem in terms of how important it is to focus on to what should I wear if aliens land on our planet? So she's saying it's, you know, vanishingly unlikely to happen, so a bit of a waste of mind power, really. but the thing to worry about, really, is that AI is already doing real harm in perpetuating racist and sexist bias. And if we continue to incorporate generative AI into our lives, the risks of those harms might also increase. So there's no need to invent new concerns right now.
Yeah, it sounds like the situation is already pretty delicate. You know, AI really is the anti-hero.
I think I know what you did there, but I may not have the right music listening to fully know what you just did. Next up, we've got a device that combines light beams, tiny beads, and chunks of sound, and it's the best one we've ever made. And if you're a little confused or not sure what all those things add up to, we are talking about something called a phonon laser, and it could eventually help us do better medical imaging or even study the deep ocean more closely. Carmela Padovich-Callahan is covering this story. Hi, Carmela.
Hello.
I just said a lot of words that people might not actually know what they mean, so can you give us a sense of what exactly a phonon laser is?
Yeah, I think it helps if we take this word by word. So let's start with laser, which is the word that you may have heard more often. And when we usually say laser, we mean a laser that outputs light or an optical laser. And what makes a laser different than other devices that output light, like light bulbs, is that laser light is focused and it's coherent and it has this sort of tight beam shape. And this is a key property of lasers. So technically, you can call anything that outputs a tight, coherent beam of any sort of particle a laser, if you'd like.
can I make a coffee laser? Because that sounds really important right now.
I would actually fully welcome this. But back to the phonon laser. So now we've got laser down. We have to explain what a phonon is. And here you should think about a mechanical vibration, like a vibration that can carry sound in a string or some sort of material. And instead of thinking about sound as one continuous thing, think about chunking it up into little particle-like bits, and these are called phonons. Physicists call them quasi-particles, and if you can build a device that outputs a coherent beam of phonons, well, congrats, you've made a phonon laser.
Right, okay. And the phonon laser you reported on this week beat its competition on multiple fronts. So what makes it the best?
Right. So for one, it could stay on for much longer than before. The team that made it had previously built some pretty good phonon lasers, but they would only stay on for, 10, 12 minutes. The new one can operate for an hour, which is much longer. And it also delivers more power at each phonon frequency, which sort of means that in analogy with conventional optical lasers, this one's much brighter than what we had before. And it's also a much more narrow beam that stays stable for longer.
So it's brighter, it's narrower, it lasts longer. How did the researchers make all of that happen?
Here, again, maybe we should think about the regular conventional light-based lasers. How do you make a laser? What are your key ingredients? So among other things, you absolutely need a source of light to get your beam, and you also need some way to shape it and amplify it, again, to get sort of the tight shape you may have seen with a laser pointer. So we want to play the same game with a phonon laser. So we need a source of phonons, and then we need some way to manipulate them. In this new experiment, the source of phonons was a very, very small silica bead, about a micrometer in size, which was levitated by some light beams. And every time this bead vibrated, even a little bit, it produced a phonon. So this is your source. Now you've got these phonons, you have to shape them. So the researchers used a sort of a reflective cavity and an electrode that would put out these special electric signals, and those two effects would combine to corral the phonons into something that looked like the output of a laser. So you can again think about a sort of coherent beam.
That sounds extremely intricate. I'm assuming researchers are working on this because it does have a practical use out in the world too. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, researchers have big ambitions for phonon lasers because phonons are less affected by having to travel through water and other liquids than light is. You know, you've probably seen like light enter a fish tank and sort of bend and slow down. Sound can be a little less attenuated than that. So this leads researchers to think about uses of phonon lasers in medical imaging, where you're trying to see what's happening in tissues that are mostly water, but also in the deep sea. So devices for monitoring what's happening in deep seas could also maybe use phonon lasers instead of optical lasers. Additionally, phonon lasers could work as intermediaries between different types of light-based devices. So you could have a device that uses microwave light and a device that uses visible light, and they could talk to each other through a phonon laser. However, your intuition is right on. I actually spoke to a researcher that echoed the same sentiment. These phonon lasers right now, especially the ones that they use this like levitated bead design, are full of tiny parts. Everything has to be calibrated very perfectly. There's sort of a vacuum bit in it even. So there's so much more engineering that will have to be done before these things can leave the lab and actually be used in the field.
Christy, I have some bad news about one of the most exciting moons in the solar system.
Sophie, I already know our moon is getting further away, and I am very sad about it.
Well, that's bad too, but let's actually talk about Europa, Jupiter's ice-covered moon. Europa is an ocean world, which gets exobiologists really excited about life. Our own ocean is one of the leading candidates for the origin of life on Earth, after all. Mm-hmm. And in that ocean, so much life is supported by the rock on the seafloor. Water interacts chemically with rocks and minerals there, and you get nutrients and energy out of that.
Right, and we've spotted all kinds of exciting molecules in some of those plumes that Europa is ejecting into space. I mean, it's definitely been seen as a good candidate for finding life, but it sounds like you have bad news for that.
Yeah. So in order to keep on extracting that constant supply of nutrients and energy from your ocean, you need a constant supply of new rock. And that either has to come from faults in the seafloor or volcanic processes like we have on Earth, which means it's really important to understand what the seafloor on Europa actually looks like. Right now, though, the closest researchers can get is simulations based on what we know about Earth. And those simulations suggest that both of these options are unlikely on Europa. So if you look at volcanism, this is a process where slabs of magma called dikes rise up from the core. And if you simulate how those dikes might move on Europa, they're absolutely insufficient. They can only transport magma like 11 kilometers from the molten parts of the moon, but the distance that magma would need to go is more like 230 kilometers.
Ah, I hate that. What about that other possibility you mentioned, just like cracks in the seafloor?
Yeah, so that could allow for nutrients to enter seawater too, but researchers also found that the amount of stress and pressure it would take to cause those cracks, it's just not there. Europa's seafloor is probably just too strong to fracture in ways that would enable more chemical reactions.
Okay, so maybe Europa is a less exciting candidate for exploration, but we still won't know for sure until we send a craft that can actually explore that ocean directly, right?
Yeah, totally.
All right, well, I'm going to hold out optimism. And here's some good news about an iconic but threatened North American tree, the giant redwood or sequoia. These can live for as many as 3,000 years, and they grow to absolutely giant sizes. Think 90 meters or nearly 300 feet tall at times. They are one of the tallest trees in the world, and it turns out that they are living their best lives in the United Kingdom.
Wait, why are there redwoods in the United Kingdom? That's very far from home, which is California, you know, that state on the Pacific coast of the U.S.?
Yes, you're correct. But like many stories of displaced plants and animals, you can thank humans, and probably colonialism, sort of, because they became a really popular status symbol for wealthy Victorians starting in the 1800s. So you would see people planting them on their grand estates, starting at an estate in Scotland, at least as far as the records show. And now there are as many as 500,000, again, in the UK. Well, meanwhile, in their indigenous range in California, there are only 80,000 left.
That's ridiculous. That's almost unfair. Mm-hmm. Why are they doing so well in the UK and not the US?
Well, it turns out that the climate of the UK is really ideal for them. It's wet, it has a much more stable range of temperatures, so the trees there aren't being threatened by the droughts or the wildfires that have been really devastating for these trees in California. And the climate is so ideal, in fact, that the trees are growing at nearly the same speed as they do in the United States, which could be really good news even for climate mitigation. Sequoias grow faster than a lot of other trees. While an oak is mature at 150 years, a sequoia is big and tall at 50 years, which means they can sequester carbon in their trunks more quickly. And on average, a mature sequoia will remove 85 kilograms of carbon from the atmosphere every year.
Okay, so maybe the sequoias in the UK can help out their long-lost American cousins.
I mean, it could be. Though even these researchers cautioned against overinvesting in trees solely for their climate benefits. Trees bring a lot of other value to ecosystems. And at the end of the day, reducing emissions is still really the only sure thing for kind of preserving biodiversity on this planet.
Okay, here's a different question for you. What meat is the most sustainable for us to eat?
I'm going to venture a guess and say it's people. Can't have you can't have historically unprecedented atmospheric carbon without us.
Calm down, Hannibal. We're talking more along the lines of snakes, maybe. Mm-hmm. That's according to a study of farms in Thailand and Vietnam where people raise pythons for food.
Okay, that's fair. And a better answer for many reasons. Why pythons?
Well, when it comes to the efficiency of converting food into flesh, snakes just seem to be the best at it. Other livestock are much more likely to spend their precious energy on, say, moving around, as opposed to bulking up their bodies, which means we need to produce more food for them and invest more resources in that food.
How do we know this? Like, how do we know how good an animal is at turning food into flesh?
It requires a very thorough process of measuring an animal's growth and mass over a year, plus weighing and measuring every single thing they eat. In this study, the researchers also weighed the dressed carcasses of the pythons, which is the snake minus the skin, internal organs, head and tail, you know, all those parts you don't want to eat.
Right.
And with a snake, the dry mass of the food they ate, it was about 1.2 times the final mass you might cook in a stew or turn into snake jerky. So you can think of that 0.2 as the proportion of food wasted on things other than making meat. If you want 1 pound of snake meat, you're going to have to feed it 1.2 pounds of food. When it comes to that number, salmon were the next best. Their food intake was about 1.5 times the mass of edible meat produced. Crickets are at 2.1, poultry like chickens at 2.8, but we have bad news for beef eaters. Cows are all the way up at 10. So to get a pound of beef, the cattle needs to eat 10 pounds of stuff first.
I know I say this a lot, Sophie, but this seems too easy. one simple trick to eat more sustainable meat and save the planet. So is there any reason I shouldn't start a small python farm in my home besides, you know, the objections of my landlord, and which are probably very reasonable?
Yeah, so there's another pretty important caveat here, which is that pythons are carnivores. Mm. So the food that the pythons are eating also has to eat food to fatten itself up, and that could involve additional waste lower in the food chain. When we're talking about other farm animals, they mostly eat plants. And while you can feed snakes on waste products like trapped rodents, we've seen it happen in the past that this type of waste product quickly becomes scarce once it's in high demand because it suddenly has value. On the other hand, snakes can also stop eating for months at a time, which makes them really resilient to scarcity in the supply chain. And it might just be more ethical to farm them because snakes willingly spend time in enclosed spaces and they're not as cognitively complex as some of the other animals we eat.
Sophie, I have a very important question about this story, which is, What does python taste like?
So I have never tried it personally, but the researchers have, and they say it tastes like chicken.
All right.
Which kind of makes sense since, you know, birds and reptiles, they got a lot of other things in common. You know, you can think of snake as a food you might have in curries or barbecue, maybe on satay snake skewers, you know, so on.
All right, I would try that.
One last quick thing. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a bipartisan bill that could ban TikTok in the United States. The bill still has to get through the Senate, but if it does, then TikTok's parent company ByteDance will have 6 months to sell the app or risk the ban. U.S. lawmakers say that ByteDance, which has its headquarters in China, could hand over sensitive information about the app's users to the Chinese government. But critics point out that a lot of social media platforms do the exact same things that TikTok is being accused of. And if China really wants sensitive data about Americans, it can just buy it from data brokers who collect information from a ton of internet-connected services, including but not limited to social media, search engines, GPS location systems, smart home appliances, cars, and shopping rewards programs.
And with that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. You can find all the stories we talked about today in the show notes, and you can subscribe to this podcast on whichever app you're currently listening on, including TikTok, I guess.
Plus, if you like the great stories we're bringing you, please give us a rating or review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Share your favorite stories, or just tell your nerdy friends. We'll be back next week. Bye for now.
Bye.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.